Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, November 8th, 2021. And as always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is known as the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships. And a tool that I can use to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about how the use of that tool has improved their life. And if you listen to those on a regular basis, they can serve as a tutorial. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Trigon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads to comments, questions, testimonials, etc. And if you have any of those comments, questions, or testimonials, we encourage you to give us a call at 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it will put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. We can have a conversation. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. And today is the 312th day of the year. And so today's lesson simply reads, I see all things as I would have them be. The commentary reads, perception follows judgment. Having judged, we therefore see what we would look upon. For sight can merely serve to offer us what we would have. It is impossible to overlook what we would see and fail to see what we have chosen to behold. How surely, therefore, must the real world come to greet the holy site of anybody who takes the Holy Spirit's purpose as his or her goal for seeing. They cannot fail to look upon what the Christ mind would have them see, and they would then share Christ's love for what they look upon. I have no purpose for today except to look upon a liberated world. That world will be set free of all judgments I have made. Creator, this is your will for us today. Therefore, it must be our goal as well. So, that's the lesson from the workbook. Here is the Course in Miracles experiment from Pam Grout, Lesson 312, A Liberated World, she calls it. She quotes Nikos Katsantzakis as saying, by believing passionately in that which does not yet exist, we create it. Pam writes, who in their right mind buys a pizza, eats one slice, and then throws the rest into the trash can? Yet, that is what I often do with my time. I throw away precious hours of my day in mindfulness, in judgment, and instead of being fully present, fully enjoying my oneness with daisies and squirrels and the driver beside me picking his nose, instead of that I analyze and scrutinize. I am often, it seems, one judgment away from reality. Lesson 312 says, I have no purpose today except to look upon a liberated world set free from all judgments I have made. As I liberate myself from my ridiculous blah, blah, blah judgments, I discover an all-absorbing, lustrous, and inexhaustible reality. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson and the Pam Grout's commentary. And as usual, we've got about 50 minutes to have your comments or questions to soften and breathe into whatever is going on for you today, and give us a call and let's discuss it. What might we be able to do to support you in creating a more loving, peaceful, creative, gratitude-based existence? 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. How can we support you today? What is on your mind? What was stirring for you this weekend that would benefit you to discuss or do a worksheet on? Or what is there about the worksheet process that still escapes you in terms of understanding how powerful it can be? Or what's the level of application of the worksheet process or the targeted journaling that Michael calls the mind shifter tool, or any other aspect of this work that we've talked about extensively for 10 and a half years now that you'd like to discuss? 563-999-3581 and press 1. Let us know what's going on for you today. Let us know how we can support you in creating a healthier, happier, more positive experience in your life. We have stepped through the 15 commitments of conscious leadership. We have talked about a whole host of books in the past 10 and a half years on Mind Shifters Radio. It's been a while since I've updated the page on mindshiftersacademy.org. But there is a page that simply talks about books we've discussed on the Mindshifter Radio podcast. And these books, the top of the list reads, The Empath Survival Guide, In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Releases Trauma and Restores Goodness by Peter Levine. Judith Orloff wrote The Empath Survival Guide. We discussed in detail Welcoming the Unwelcome by Pema Chodron. We discussed in pretty much detail Healing Depression Without Medication by Dr. Jody Skillcorn. Several books by Pema Chodron, When Things Fall Apart, etc. We talked about Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whittaker. Necessary Endings by Dr. Henry Cloud. We've talked at length about The Way of Mastery and read some sections of that book, which I call the kinder, gentler version of the Course in Miracles. We've talked about a lot of different things over the past 10 and a half years. 365 Blessings to Heal Myself and the World by Pierre Pratervand, also by Pierre, The Gentle Art of Blessing. And we've talked about them as powerful tools for helping us create that more gentle, peaceful, loving, rewarding life. So what would you like to talk about today? Give us a call and make a suggestion. At least suggest a topic or a refresher course on one of the books I've listed. Taking Flight by Anthony DeMello is a book of story meditations. Also by Anthony DeMello, the book Awareness, which finds its way into my rereading cycle every once or twice a year. We started a discussion about difficult conversations, and there's a book that was written from the I think it's a Harvard group, Harvard Negotiation Project, titled Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. And in its 10th anniversary edition, they updated it with answers to the 10 most frequently answered questions or frequently asked questions about difficult conversations. And, you know, if you're looking for an outline, a plan for having a difficult conversation with somebody, and you're finding that doing reality management worksheets or targeted journaling from Mindshifter perspective hasn't freed you up enough to have the conversation, this is a book you might enjoy, because they're looking at it from an analytical perspective, and they try to describe to you how to decipher the underlying structure of every difficult conversation, how to interpret the significance of what is said and what is not said, how to raise tough issues without triggering defensiveness, which is one of the most challenging things. And I would say something you don't have control over, so take a look at that section and read it lightly and then put it aside, because if I spend too much energy trying to construct what I'm saying in a way that it will not do this or that, or it will do this or that in terms of someone else's response, I'm wasting a lot of my energy, because I don't have control over other people's responses and emotions. And that's the It's a fundamental observation in this work. I can control and I'm responsible for my own emotions and reactions, and I cannot control or be responsible for the emotions and reactions of anybody else, no matter how hard I try. In the book, they also want to help you learn how to manage strong emotions. And here again, they say, manage yours and manage theirs. And again, I would say it's not my job to manage somebody else's emotions. I don't have access to that. I don't have the power to control it. And all the energy I place on reaching that is potentially energy that's going to get me trapped and yield unproductive results. And then they say, and this is a point I would agree with, they teach you how to stay balanced regardless of how the other person responds. So, why we argue and why it doesn't help. One reason we argue is we think they are the problem, right? But it doesn't work because we are part of the interaction. And so we can think that it's not going to work and they're the problem because they're selfish or they're naive or they're controlling or they're irrational. But when we have any of those judgments, just like the Course in Miracles lesson today would say, when I hold those judgments, that's going to drive my perception. And I'm going to see all of the ways that they are selfish, they are naive, they are controlling, and they are irrational. And there's no doubt about why I keep arguing or they keep arguing. So it's critical to release judgment. It's critical to cancel goals for people to be different than they are. It's critical for me to cancel a goal for someone to be different than they are in order for me to have access to seeing them as they truly are. And when we don't want to argue, then we're not sure what to do, because we're seeing them in all of this negative judgment, and the arguing seems to unfold, you know, incessantly, and we're not sure what to do. But that's why we feel so strongly about the situation in the first place. If arguing leads us nowhere, what else can we do but argue? Then there's the issue where they think we are the problem. Then there's the issue that we each make sense of our story of what happened, and we ask our mind to show us how we're right and they're wrong. And in the arguing, it literally blocks us from exploring the other person's side of the story. And whenever I'm arguing without completely understanding the other person's perspective, I never persuade them. And I'm never persuaded. They talk about how we each see the world from our unique perspective, just like the Course in Miracles lesson today is talking about how what I judge, what I want, literally creates my perception. And it creates a world for me to see that is as negative as the judgment that I made. They talk about one of the blocks to this process is that we each know ourselves better than anyone else can. And so on top of choosing different information than the person across the wall or across the table or across the desk from us, we each have access to different information, and we know about our hopes and dreams and our frustrations in ways they don't. Our different interpretations are experienced by how we each have past influences that are different and how we apply different rules about how the world should work and how it does work. And we have different perceptions because our conclusions, what we see, what the world looks like to us, is going to reflect our own self-interest. So, again, here's another technique, another system that says it's really important to move from certainty to curiosity. That's one of the first keys in the 15 commitments to conscious leadership. Is in the second commitment. I commit to growing in self-awareness. I commit to regarding every interaction as an opportunity to learn. And I commit to curiosity as a path to rapid learning. So here we are, how to have difficult conversations. One of the ways we move out of arguing is to choose to move from certainty, I know I'm right and they're wrong, I know what I know the facts, to curiosity. How can they think that? Instead of asking, how can they think that with the certainty that they're wrong and you're right, ask, I wonder what information they have that I don't have. Instead of asking, how can they be so irrational, ask myself, how might they see the world such that their view makes sense? And if I'm willing to start moving from certainty to curiosity, and if I'm willing to ask more actual wonder questions, I wonder what information they have that I don't. I wonder how they see the world in such a way that makes this perspective make sense to them. That's how I get access to their story. Another way is to question, how did I get so certain about my perspective? I need to question, how did I come to the conclusions that I've reached? What are my data sources? And again, as we talk about so often in this work, anytime I step into a process of thought, problem solving, etc., and I end up feeling a negative emotion, I could choose to use that as an alarm system to notify me that there's something in error about my thought process. And another important step in this is to adopt the and stance. So I'm right and they're right. There's a way in which I'm right and there's a way in which they're right. Again, here's a parallel to the 15 commitments of conscious leadership. I commit to understanding that the opposite of my story is as truer than my original story. And I recognize that I interpret the world around me, and I'm the one that gives my stories meaning. Here's another tool from the Harvard Group on Negotiations, Difficult Conversations book. Adapt the and stance. The and stance is based on the assumption that the world is complex, and that you can feel hurt, angry, and wronged, and they can feel just as hurt, angry, and wronged. They can be doing their best, and you can think it's not good enough. You may have done something stupid, and they will have contributed in important ways to the problem just as well as you have. you can feel furious with them, and you can also feel love and appreciation for them. If you move into the and stance, it gives you a place from which to assert the full strength of your views and feelings without having to diminish the views and feelings of the other person. And you might be thinking that the advice to shift from certainty to arguing to curiosity, certainty and arguing to curiosity and the and stance generally makes sense, but there must be exceptions, right? And so then they say, let's look at these two exceptions that aren't really exceptions. They seem like they are. What's the first exception? But I really am right. I really am right, except so can the other person be right at the same time I'm right. And then there's the idea of the exception of needing to give bad news. And what they say here is, when you have to give bad news, the and stance is probably the most powerful place to stand when engaging in a difficult conversation that requires you to deliver or enforce bad news. If you're breaking up with someone, it allows you to say, I'm breaking up with you because it's the right thing for me to do, and here's why, and I understand how hurt you might be by this, and that you think we might, you know, we should try again, and I'm not changing my mind. It allows us to embrace and move around the wheel of perspective to see a variety of different ways to look at or analyze a situation. And flexibility and the need for seeing a situation from a variety of perspectives is one of the primary ways out of a difficult or into and through a difficult conversation, certainly out of an argument. So, what are your comments, questions, what are your thoughts about having difficult conversations with people, potentially the role of the reality management worksheet, or the targeted journaling that Michael calls a mind shifter tool in that process? 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1. We've got about 30 minutes left. How is this sitting with you? What are your thoughts about these conversations? What gets stirred up for you if you notice it when I start pointing out how much overlap there is from one deep, powerful system like the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership and the book on difficult conversations from the Harvard Group on negotiating? How does it strike you to understand, to see so often, or do you find value, as I do, in looking for the similarities from one philosophy, one religion, one psychological perspective to another, rather than looking for and trying to argue for how one is right and the other is wrong? That's one of the perspectives that's given me such value over the years, when I learned to look for the similarities rather than scan for and then point out the differences. Most of the time when I'm scanning for and pointing out the differences from one philosophy or one religion or one psychological perspective or another, what I'm doing is looking for who's right and who's wrong. And this and perspective, this understanding that so many truths that I see as true have also their opposite being as true or truer than what I'm committed to seeing as the truth. That's one of the more amazing observations. I remember years ago when I was listening to an interview with a physicist, and the physicist said, you know, one of the problems we have in the Western world is that we are so focused on proving who's right and who's wrong and seeing the world as this black and white world, when in truth, when in actuality, one of the hallmarks of any deep truth is that its opposite is also true. Let that sink in. How, and for the Western mind, and I think, you know, most of the people that I'm addressing right now are from the Western mindset, that just seems ridiculous. So the physicist said, well, here's an example from my field of work. For years, people went around thumping their chests, proclaiming that they know the truth about light, that light is a particle. And then others would say, no, light is a wave. And it would go back and forth like this, with the arguing being a very popular topic, whether it was in the journal articles that were being quoted or the cocktail party conversations, and people arguing loudly for who's right and who's wrong. And then eventually what happened was they developed the technology to the point where they could actually track the fact that, guess what? Light sometimes acts as a particle, and light sometimes acts as a wave. And both are true. So when I say, well, this is just the way it is and it can't be any other way, for most of the things that have any significant consequence, that's probably not the whole picture. It's like the difference between what Newtonian physics observes and quantum physics observes. There are things in the quantum physics realm that blatantly contradict what people would say is an absolute indisputed fact from Newtonian physics. What might that be? Well, in Newtonian physics, it's common that people say opposites attract. And they say that for reasons like what happens when the north pole of a magnet is put near a south pole of a magnet, they attract. And if you put the north pole of a magnet near a north pole of a magnet, they repel each other. So opposites attract and likes repel. And that's something you can observe in the realm of Newtonian physics. Oddly, by the time you get down to the quantum level, the submolecular level, the opposite is true, and like attracts like. So what's the truth? Like attracts like, or opposites attract? Well, because it's a deep truth, people get to learn they're both true. They're both true. So, what's the thought about what you have thought is absolutely true and you've later discovered the opposite is also true? For most of us, the bulk of those situations are going to be where we thought we understood what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, whether it's for politics or religion or a relationship issue. And the more we stay open, the more we get curious, the more we're going to be shown that the opposite of what we thought was true is also true. That there are ways in which we can interact with the world that leave us in that opening questioning space, and that that's far more productive than deciding that we know what's right and we're right and the other person is wrong. It almost never ends well for us. So, 563-999-3581. What's a comment? What's a question about what we're discussing from Difficult Conversations, the Harvard Negotiation Project, or anything else that's on your mind for today? The Harvard Negotiation Project goes on to talk about if you're trying to get through a difficult conversation, it's really important to try and disentangle from one from the other, intent from impact. When I have an intention and I make a statement, especially in a situation where someone might have a strong emotional response to the outcome of the discussion, it is really common for the impact of my words to be very different than my intention. And significant work needs to be done in most situations where an argument or a discussion is turned into an argument, a significant amount of work needs to be done to disentangle the intent from the impact. It says, here's an example of the story of Lori and Leo, and they've been in a relationship for 2 years, and they have a recurring fight, and the recurring fight is painful to both of them. And the couple was at a party thrown by some friends, and Lori was about to reach for another scoop of ice cream when Leo said, "Lori, why don't you lay off the ice cream?" Lori, who struggles with her weight, shot Leo a nasty look, and the two avoided each other for a while. Later that evening, things went from bad to worse. And Lori said, "I really resented it at the party, the way you treated me in front of our friends." And Leo said, "The way I treated you, what are you talking about?" And Lori said, "About the ice cream. You act like you're my father or something. You have this need to control me or put me down." And Leo said, "Lori, I wasn't trying to hurt you. You said you were on a diet. I'm just trying to help you stick to it." "You're so defensive. You hear everything as an attack on you, even when I'm trying to help." And Lori says, "Help? Humiliating me in front of my friends is your idea of helping?" And Leo says, "You know, I just can't win with you. If I say something, you think I'm trying to humiliate you. And if I don't, you ask me why I let you overeat. I'm so sick of this. Sometimes I wonder whether you don't start these fights just on purpose." Now, most of us can relate to having been in a conversation similar to that. And they try to point out two key mistakes. Two crucial mistakes in this conversation make it infinitely more difficult than it needs to be. One mistake by Lori and one by Leo. And when Lori says, "You have this need to control me or put me down," she's talking about Leo's intentions. Not what he actually said, but what she believes he meant by it. Her mistake is to assume that she knows what Leo's intentions are, when the fact is she doesn't. And it's an easy and debilitating mistake to make. Most of us do it on a regular basis. Leo's mistake is to assume that once he clarifies that his intentions were good, Lori is no longer justified in being upset. He explains that he wasn't trying to hurt Lori, that in fact he was trying to help. And he's thinking, having explained this, this should be the end of the argument. As a result, he doesn't take time to learn what Lori's really feeling or why. And this mistake, too, is as common as it is crippling. Here's our first mistake. We make assumptions about intentions, and many times they are wrong. And the fundamental mechanism for us creating our assumption about intentions is the impact it has on us. But when we do that, we're ignorant of the fact. We are not paying attention to the fact that the other person doesn't really know the impact on us. We are the ones that create our own impact. This goes back to the talk we were having earlier about how each of us creates our own experience of life. And even in today's Course in Miracles lesson, if I have judgments, if I want the world to be different than it is, those judgments, those wantings, literally shape my perception in the moment, and it makes me see things that other people may not see because they're not really even there for other people. Right? If I'm creating my own perception and everyone I'm dealing with is creating their own perception, then the way they want things to be is creating what they see, and the way I want things to be is creating what I see. The judgments I make that this is bad or good, this is wrong or right, literally are the mechanism that create what I perceive, what I see, how the world looks through my eyes. And that's a core piece of today's Course in Miracles lesson. So on a regular basis, if I choose to see the world through someone else's eyes, or I choose to see the world the way the Holy Spirit would see it, I'm going to open up the possibilities for seeing more solutions. More clearly, I might see how what I said creates an impact on someone else. And that is a useful part of working through, moving through difficult conversations, getting curious, asking about the difference between what I intended and what the impact was. And when I'm convinced that the other person has a negative intention, and I assume they have a bad character, or I assume they had bad negative intentions, then it creates the likelihood that the other person will get defensive or will feel attacked. And the second mistake that I could make is I could assume that just because I had good intentions, there is no negative impact on the other person. And so I want to stay open to the fact that despite my positive intentions, someone could create a negative response to something I said. And the good news is avoiding these two mistakes is possible. So how to avoid the first mistake? You want to disentangle impact and intent. in this example, how can Lori avoid the mistake of attributing intentions to Leo that may not be there? Her first step is simply to recognize that there is a difference between the impact she creates and what Leo may have intended. Because she can't get anywhere without disentangling the two. So if I'm going to separate impact from intentions, it requires me to be aware of an automatic leap from the thought, I'm hurt, to you intended to hurt me. How do you stop doing that? You can make this distinction by asking yourself three questions. What did the other person actually say or do? What was the impact on me of this? And then my assumption, based on this impact, what assumption am I making about what the other person intended? If I'm willing to hold those three questions, I'm on the path to disentangling impact from intention. And to get there, I have to just say, okay, here's my thought. Here's my guess. Here's the story I'm telling myself now. And that softens it and brings it to a space of ownership for me rather than stating it as a fact, I know they meant to hurt me. And then the next step is that I get to share the impact. And it might look like this. Lori might say, you know, when you said, why don't you lay off the ice cream, I felt hurt by that. And Leo would probably respond, you did? ? And Lori would say, yeah, I was just, you know, really hurt by that comment. And Leo might say, well, I was just trying to help you stay off your diet. Why does that make you upset? And then Lori can talk about why she felt embarrassed and how it was in front of other people. And then Leo can talk about, well, I guess I didn't pay attention to that it might be embarrassing for you. So important keys are, don't pretend that you don't have a hypothesis. We are almost always making these guesses and projecting them onto others. And so it's really good to say, here's what's going on inside of me. Here's the story I'm telling myself now. Here's the impact on me based on the interpretation I made of what you said. And sharing that with the other person is the beginning of unraveling the impact from the intention. And then, as always, I want to catch defensiveness, because whenever I get defensiveness, I'm calling this resistance, tension, anger, frustration, any of that is defensiveness. All of those are the negative emotions I talk about so often in this work as the alarm system, the evidence of my own internal alarm going off that's most usefully interpreted by me as evidence that my thoughts are off the mark. No matter what else is going on, if I move to defensiveness, if I move to a negative emotion, my thoughts are off the mark. The best use of my energy at that point in time is to take a step back, take a deep breath, turn the focus inside myself and ask myself, how am I creating this negative emotion? Another really good question for me to ask is, what am I making this situation that I'm currently in, what am I making this mean? If I'm following Diedrich Wolzak's work, it might be really useful for me to say, okay, I'm acknowledging I'm upset. I'm acknowledging this is my creation. I'm going to ask myself, what's the name of the emotion I'm feeling? And then I'm going to ask myself, is this a familiar emotion? And Diedrich says, it will always be a familiar emotion. And then the next step is asking, when is one of the first times I remember feeling this emotion in my life? And if and when a thought comes up about an earlier time, an earlier interaction with someone, and I pay attention to where I was, how old I was, who else was there, and what's happening, when I look at that situation from an earlier age, and I ask myself, what did I make that interaction, that situation, mean about me? I'm going to find that I downloaded a negative belief about myself. And I can step into the process of dismantling that negative belief, either with reality management worksheets and or EFT tapping and or the process that Diedrich Wolsack himself outlines of, you know, saying over and over again that I forgive myself for believing this negative thing. I forgive myself for forgetting the positive about myself. And in that process, get very clear about what I was doing to create the upset that my mind was trying to tell me was created by someone or something outside of me. And that's the path to liberty. Guided by my own negative emotions, when I can step into closer and closer to being 100% responsible for the emotions and energies and beliefs about myself that I'm creating and or holding on to, I get closer to the liberty that I say I want. I get closer to the kindness, the appreciation, the love, the joy that, as Michael Rice would say, these are my birthright. And that's what we're here to support people in doing. So we've got maybe 5 or 6 minutes left. How is this landing for you? 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1 and let us know if this is making any sense, if this is useful, what you'd like to have as a topic for a future day this week. Comments, questions, answers, even soliloquies. We've got 5 minutes left. There's plenty of time for a soliloquy. I suppose I should look that word up and make sure it's an appropriate use of that word. In that offering, what's on your mind? We have 4 or 5 people in the calling queue, no one in the chat room right now. I should mention that we have a support group coming up this week, Tuesday and Thursday, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central, as we do most weeks. You can find out about that on MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And it's free to join. You can either join us yourself or pass that information along to someone you think might be interested. Again, that'll be tomorrow, Tuesday and Thursday, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. So, what's on your mind? How can we support you? I had somebody in the office earlier today making some significant progress on identifying that negative emotional state as the prompt for doing some work, internal work. And here's a person who absolutely knows that she doesn't want to move backwards in a situation, in a relationship. And yet, she keeps watching herself do things that keep her stuck in the current status and prevent her from moving forward. And so we're asking her to step into this level of observation, just like what we're talking about today. How am I creating this experience for myself? What am I making the situation mean? And until she's able to ask that often enough and listen with openness to the response, she's going to stay stuck, because we do things for a reason. Right? This is one of the things we observe over and over again. That's why the 10 bottom line observations, the first one, is the hardest one right up front. The first observation is, if whatever I'm doing is not working, I should feel free to try something else. And yet, trying something else, breaking the pattern of doing what's not working, is one of the hardest things we'll ever encounter. And the reason for that is because, not because we're sick or crazy or stupid or lazy, but because whether it's at a conscious level or an unconscious level, we have reasons for doing whatever we do. And when we have a reason for doing something, it makes it almost impossible to break out of the cycle of going against our really good reasons. So yeah, most people say right off the bat, oh my gosh, that's ridiculously simple. I don't know why you would even have that as a list. Of course, if what you're doing isn't working, you should feel free to try something else. And yet, most of those people wake up and realize at one point or another in their lives, it's really hard to quit doing what they've been doing that isn't working. And the reason is, because I'm not sick, I'm not crazy, I'm not stupid, I'm not lazy, and I'm not masochistic. I do not enjoy the pain. And if that's true, what it means is I have really good reasons for doing it, even if it didn't work the last 17 times I did it. When it rolls around in my mind the next time, something about it, my desire to avoid something or my desire to hold on to something, will drive my perception. Like the Course in Miracles says, you must come to understand the distorting power of how you want things to be. Because if you don't come to understand that distorting power, that power will distort your perception, and your perception will drive your view of the world, and your view of the world drives your behaviors. And that's, you know, the long and short of how we get stuck in cycles of doing things that are not productive. So hopefully this has been of some use to you. This is the end of our Monday show for the first hour. Michael and Jeannie should be here for the second hour. I'll remind us all that we are coming from love. We are made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love. And everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I hope you had a good weekend.
I did indeed. I hope the same for you, and have a great show.
Thank you. Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Monday, November the 8th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. While we're waiting on Michael to call in, I will just say that I'm going to be posting on the website. You may have seen it already on our Facebook pages, but Michael is going to be doing a program on Veterans Day on Thursday, November the 11th at 11:11 a.m. And it's going to be translated by Nene in Spanish. So it will be in both English and Spanish. So that's awesome. So watch on our website under events. I'll be putting that up this afternoon. And like I said, you may have already seen it on our Facebook pages. But everybody's invited to tap into that. It's going to be on Facebook. So it'll be a live program. And we're looking forward to participating in that. I'll invite you to go to our website, which is whyagain.org. And you can click on the Start Here button, or you can scroll down, hit the bullseye. Both of those take you to the same place. And that's where you'll find all the tools the worksheets. You'll find Michael's book. You'll find posters, special MP3 radio shows, lots and lots of information out there. Under the special radio shows, I have also added just the other day, let me find it here, the Why Do Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing. That was a radio show from October the 5th. I have also put on where Ellen called in and talked to Michael on October 27th and 28th. We've combined those into one MP3. And then also where Dr. Tim walks Ellen through a wake-up sheet on November 3rd. So all of that now is under the special shows. So click on those and give a listen. If there's another special show that I have overlooked where we have explained the forgiveness process or walked somebody through it, and I don't have that listed under the special page, if you would drop me a note at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and let me know which show it was, and I will get it edited and put out there. And so we hope that you had a good weekend and that you're starting your week off right. And we invite you to put the tools to work. You know, you don't have to believe it, but if you put them to work, you'll see that they do work. Welcome, Michael. I had given a brief intro for people to watch the website that I'd be putting the link out that you were going to be doing Thursday, November the 11th at 11:11, a show or a Facebook live presentation that would also be translated into Spanish. So you might want to give a little more detail on that one.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do, some of you heard Nene Ortega on the show before. And so Nene has done teacher training and studied this work for several years, done presentations in South America. And so this is specifically geared to the Spanish community. So I'll be presenting the information in English, and she'll be translating into Spanish. And we'll have that, once it's complete, available on our website as well. So, and, of course, the topic is going to be first century Aramaic forgiveness and the how do we achieve a state of serenity. What's the title of it is actually The Missing Piece, P-E-A-C-E. And so that's what we're going to talk about. And if you want to come play, keep an eye on the links, and I'm sure when Jeannie gets it together, it'll also be in the notes for the radio show. So welcome. Honored that you're here. Once again, as we move forward into this amazing conversation, it's the only conversation I know that's been going on for 10 years. And it continues, and it gets more and more refined, and we reach deeper and deeper levels of understanding all the time. And the idea is, you know, in the ancient teachings, they said, know the truth. You want to have liberty? Know the truth. Not know somebody's dogma, not know somebody's doctrine. Know the truth. And, you know, one of the things that that inhibits people getting to truth is that they have no idea how the mind works, and that they're living in such a way, they're operating the mind in such a way that the mind lives in blockage of truth. For those years ago, and you know, this is a development that happened over years of teaching laws of living. Some of you might remember being in a laws of living class 30 years ago with Dr. Dan McDougall and myself. And we talked about blockage of personal error. And that was a conversation for many years. And that we made mistakes and we blocked awareness of our mistakes. But one day when teaching that class, we stepped into the place of, wait a minute, when we're in error, we see our errors. We're not in blockage of truth at all. The problem is that we call our errors truth. And by filling the mind with our error and calling it truth, we end up in blockage of truth. So let's do a little bit of review of some of the science. Let's go back and listen to It's the Harvard research that we use often that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, the max amount of data that goes into the perceptual construct of your mind is 9 bits. It's been estimated that perhaps in that same time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, there may potentially be 20 trillion bits of data available in the actual world. You know, you think about an ant, and an ant looks at a mountain and a lake and a sunset. What do you suppose the ant comprehends about the mountain, the lake, and the sunset with its perceptual apparatus? You know, an ant has eyes. Why doesn't it see what you and I see? Because its mechanism is not designed to show it what our mechanism is designed to show us. So a mosquito is flying around. What does a mosquito see? Oh, infrared. That means warmth. Warmth means there's probably a warm-blooded creature over there, and therefore I can eat. Do you think, as you sit and work on your 5,000-piece puzzle, that the mosquito is getting ready to land on your head and put its proboscis into your skin and draw some blood? Do you think the mosquito has any perceptual construct that resembles anything that you see when you look at this 5,000-piece puzzle half finished and have the comprehension of, oh, my God, the work I have to do? Oh, geez. I was talking to him in a store the other day. I was looking at toys and puzzles. And she said, oh, I love to do puzzles. And I got so frustrated because I went and I bought this puzzle. And the puzzle has, I forget how many pieces, but it was a couple thousand pieces. And it has 5 extra pieces. And there's no box top. So, you know, what does that mosquito perceive? It's landing right there on top of your head. Its eyes look down to the same place as your eyes look at the puzzle. Do you think it goes, oh, my God, am I ever going to get this puzzle together? Oh, what's the next edge piece? Oh, my God, there are 5 extra pieces. Oh, jeez, how am I? Do you think the mosquito? So what if our 9-bit minds in what is perhaps a 20-trillion-bit world is trying to comprehend something that it just has no idea of, that it's so far out of reach? And what do you suppose an egocentric mind that says, I have to know, does? Makes up all kinds of stories, all kinds of dogmas and doctrines and all sorts of things to try to get some comprehension in this 9-bit mind of what it looks like. And guess what? Probably 99.9% of what most make up an error and call their error the truth and then go forcing other people, you know, in the name of love, if you won't believe what I say, I'm going to send you to hell, or somebody's going to send you to hell. How well do you suppose that person with their mosquito mind is thinking about the puzzle of life? How truly do you suppose their doctrine or dogma, which sounds so good and in the name of love is reinforced with fear and intimidation and hostility and raging and screaming, how much truth do you suppose you're going to find there? Well, probably not going to be very much. So if we live in blockage of truth, we make up a lie. We fill the 9-bit mind with it, and then we call our lie the truth. Then we're going to do all kinds of crazy things to try to make it look like it's true. The indicator in the human mind, the human mind is doing is not the truth, is that there's hostility and fear active in the mind. Hostility and or fear. So if you get to the core tool that we're offering, it's the tool of forgiveness. It has nothing whatsoever to do with letting other people off the hook for what's happening inside of you. It's got nothing to do with your perception being accurate about them and that it's all their fault, and therefore you let them off the hook for it. Forgiveness in the Aramaic language, the tool as it was described, collapses the perceptual construct in your mind that is a lie that you call the truth. If you're in hostility or fear and you think your mind's telling you the truth, your mind's full of it. You're in blockage of truth, but you're calling your lie the truth. What Yeshua taught 2,000 years ago, and the more I work with this, the more it just boggles my mind. I mean, think about the mosquito that opens up and comprehends the puzzle. It boggles my mind to think that somebody 2,000 years ago had this kind of understanding, that if you're in a lie, calling your lie the truth, the solution is collapsing the lie. And by collapsing the lie, that 9-bit space becomes available for truth to come in. And if you make yourself available to truth, truth will totally reorganize your lies. And your diseases are all based in your lies. There is no such thing as a disease in a human form without a lie in that same human form. You know, you'll hear Dr. Tim oftentimes say, approach something with a fresh mind and a mind that says, maybe everything I know or think I know about this is in error. Then I can become available to truth. And if you want to define truth, the best definition I've been able to come up with is, truth is what is. And if you can stop trying to superimpose your perceptual constructs on the truth, what will happen is the energy field, the energy pattern that is truth, will enter into you and restructure you according to the truth. But you've got to be available. And you can't be available if you've got a perceptual construct that says, oh, no, the problem is Harry over there, Mary over here, Bill over there. And you'll notice if you've been through a particular painful reality 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. It's your mind that's in the blockage truth. It's not theirs. Well, theirs might be too. But guess what? Strictly speaking, if you're in hostility or fear, therefore in blockage truth, their error is none of your business. You've got work to do of your own. And when you realize how profoundly connected, pardon me, I shouldn't say connected. I should say how perception, that construct of the mind, is a reflection of your so-called body, and your body is a reflection of your perception. They are one thing. People do not perceive them that way, so they have difficulty connecting them. Let's use an example. Imagine I've got a silver dollar, and I don't know these days whose head is on the front side of the silver dollar, but let's take a man, you know, from somewhere remote in the world, isolated, uneducated, no contact with anything or anybody that knows anything about the modern world. And we hold the silver dollar in our hand. Actually, we hold two silver dollars in hand. And one silver dollar we show this fellow, and as I say, I don't know who's on the silver dollar at this point, but let's say it's George Washington. And this man looks at the silver dollar and he says, that's a man. I have that much knowledge. And we say, well, would you like to know his name? He says, sure, George Washington. Okay. So that's George Washington. And then we show him the second silver dollar and we show him the other side. And on the other side of it, there's a bird. And he says, that's a bird. We say, yes, you're right, that's an eagle. But because he does not know what a coin is, eagle way over here to the left and George Washington way over to the right have nothing to do with each other. But in fact, if he could only comprehend it, they are one coin. We're looking at one side and seeing an eagle, the other side and seeing George Washington. That's your so-called body. When you look at the constructs of your body, the thing called perception, that is a reflection of a way of looking at your body the same way as looking at the bird is a way of looking at the coin. If you look at your body, that would be the other side of the coin, George Washington, it's something not related to that bird over there. But when you really look at it, just like the coin, the head and the tail are not two separate things. They are different sides of the same thing. And until this man can comprehend what a coin is, it's going to look like a bird and George Washington, a bird and a man, and that's it. And so it is with most people. Oh, I have a body and I have a mind. But they don't have anything, they don't have anything to do with the other way. I've got the mind over here. I've got the body over here. If I have rage and fear and guilt firing off in my mind and I'm in deep pain perception, probably blaming someone else, well, that has nothing to do with the fact that, you know, I have this horrific cancel the thought pain in my gut. You know, body's over there, mind's over there. It's a comprehension that they are each reflections of exactly the same thing. Healing becomes, real healing becomes a difficult project. When you realize that pained perception reflects in the body as a dis-ease process, and a dis-ease process in the body will reflect as pained perception, then you have a key way to moving into the cause level of what it takes to heal the body. And there is no healing of the body if you don't heal its reflection, and vice versa. There's no healing of perception if you don't deal with what's going, the energy patterns that are going on within the body or the so-called body. And the reason for that is because there is no body to begin with. There's only energy. And if we listen to Einstein, he says, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy, energy whose vibrations have become so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. There's no such thing as material substance. There is energy organized into the appearance of form. What's the master organizer? If you go to the opening words in the book of John, it doesn't say, as the Greeks would tell us, in the beginning was the word became flesh. It says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. So your mind energy is going to reflect as your physiology. If you have diseased mind energy, hostility or fear going on, then your physiology is going to be in pain, and it's going to be diseased. If you have diseased physiology, pain going on in your physiology, then you're going to have perceptual constructs based in that pain, and they're going to be called some reflection of hostility or fear. You can't heal one without the other. And you can't have one without the other. And so what we're looking to do is to give people a tool. You know, there's been, so many thousands of man hours, years of man hours put into studying disease. And if the people who put their thousands of hours into studying disease understood that when, through their perceptual apparatus, they allow a dis-ease energy to enter, their physiology will become diseased, they'd start to question themselves in their study of disease. It's interesting. There's a thing that's been recognized in all of the dis-ease schools. It's called the second-year syndrome. And by the second year, and it doesn't matter whether it's in the so-called physical disease realm or the psychological or what have you, but by the second year of focus on and study of disease, these students are developing the diseases that they're studying. Why? Because you can't have one without the other. The study of disease will profit you nothing, ever. You don't need to know anything about diseases. If you know the cause of health and you make that your study and your focus, because your perceptual apparatus will only be focusing in and bringing in frequencies that support life, then your physiology is going to be filled with life. And you remember this man Yeshua 2,000 years ago said, I come to bring you life and bring life more abundantly. So our work in this, under this title of Why Is This Happening to Me Again, is about understanding the principles behind how we create our lives and how to change our creative process. Most people never take control of that faculty because they live in the has-been. And if you've been following along with us, we've been reading from the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And What You Can Do About It. And that we're on is Waking from the Has-Been, chapter 20. If you're following along with us in the book, we're on page 140. So moving out of the has-been, and the has-been basically says, everything that's stored in this container called a body-mind unit, by definition, if it's stored there, it's stored there because somewhere in someone's past, that individual came into the experience of that energy. And if we allow ourselves to get lost in the experience of those energies based in hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, pain, drama, and trauma, condemnation, gossip, slander, vengeance, if we allow ourselves to get focused there, then we're going to be engaging in the cause, suffering, and death. How many generations? You know, there's a song back a few years ago. How long has this been going on? Well, let's take a look at our history books. How long has this conflict and suffering and pain and trauma and drama and hatred and vengeance and war, degradation of self and others, how long has that been going on? Well, for about as long as recorded history's been there. And so in the has-been of each individual on the earth, there's this highly emotionally charged trap called rage and vengeance and punishment and guilt and grief. And most people's perceptual constructs, at least to some degree, are based in that, which means it's based in their disease. Disease not being an energy, or pardon me, not being an entity like disease, there's just a thing that's out to get us, but dis-ease is a lack of a state of ease, that there is stored somewhere in the structure an energetic pattern that does not belong in the structure. And so what forgiveness does is forgiveness gives us a tool with which to collapse perception. And when you collapse perception, it collapses in on itself and gives you direct access to what it is that's distorting physiology. And when you remove that, physiology is restored. That's the genius of first century Aramaic forgiveness. And so what we're looking to do is to bring forward the deepest possible level of understanding of these tools and to move into the space where the tools become functional. And so I just finished explaining to Richard that spiritual teachings give people tools, rituals, with which to bring forward our true nature and to undo what never belonged. And it's not hocus pocus, it's not mystical, it's not anything other than it's just what the energy is. It's energy that exists on a higher level, mind energy, and we're looking to understand the impact that that has, and if it's had an impact, how to undo it. The mind, storing everything from the past, will tend to continue to generate perceptions based in the past, and people will be stuck in that past. And what we're looking to do is to support people awakening and going beyond that and to realize that they are the thinker. The thinker is not the thought. They are the actor. The actor is not the action. So I go along with, move forward with Richard in the conversation. Once a person realizes there's another way to live life and there are real tools available for doing spiritual work, it often seems as though nothing else matters. Finding this other way of living in the Aramaic was called, quote, finding the pearl of great price. It's exciting to catch the vision of a new self, alive and vibrating with the delight of existence, coming into expression, the old painful life of the mind passing away. In its roots, this spiritual process was known as awakening or being reborn, a very real experience. But we're not talking about the mind that has no clue of what's really going on, making up stories about it. What we're looking to do is to give people very real, practical tools that operate right where you live. You know, Michael, when someone asks, have you been reborn? I usually feel like I'm about to be pounced on if I don't answer the right way, the way they expect. I feel like I'll be cut off because I'm not part of their in crowd. And I offer Richard the thought. I think you will find that the person who uses force and becomes obnoxious when asking a question about being reborn is not as reborn as they would like to think. Love does not abuse. It gently demonstrates what it has found and holds the space for others to find the gift. Some people get genuinely enthusiastic, perhaps overly enthusiastic, in their desire to help others define what they've experienced. Oftentimes that can lead to a little overzealousness. I see that there's another level of meaning behind quote-unquote reborn, Richard said pensively. I'm ready to wake up. I want that process over with yesterday. Let's do it. Richard was at a new level of enthusiasm. Slow down a little, Richard. If you get ahead of yourself, you'll wreak havoc in your life. In the Aramaic, people were warned, quote, not to storm the gates, not to go too quickly. Doing your inner work is a process that takes time, and remaining in balance throughout that process makes life much easier, I cautioned. Each of the tools we offer is designed to assist in keeping that balance. Some people get so excited about the intellectual aspect of the work, they forget to use the tools. Using them is of paramount importance for the maintaining of balance. And so that's our conversation today with Richard. And what I'd like to do is just open the phone lines. Miss Jeannie, we got anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room? Hello, Jeannie.
My phone disappeared. It was like trying to get it back on, find out where it was. No, it's all – oh, we just had a hand go up. Area code 417.
Awesome.
I think this is Miss Judy.
Oh, let's say hello to Judy. Hey, young lady.
Hello, hello.
Hey, how do you be?
Good. Working on to death. Healing and mending.
You're working on – say it again. I didn't hear the word you used. You're working on?
Stuff.
Oh, stuff. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Working through your
stuff.
Yeah. I understand.
I had a question about what you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
On perception. Did you and I just want some clarification on it. Were you saying, and are you saying, that our body is a manifestation of our perception?
Well, I would say it slightly differently. Our body is, our so-called body is a manifestation of the creative process, but it's a reflection of our perception.
A reflection of it, okay.
Yeah. So there,
okay.
You know, a signal comes in by your, on your TV. It's a digital piece of information, and the digital piece of information is converted into a picture. So you've got a signal. If you were to look at it in the wires, it would be this movement of electrons. And then when these electrons hit your screen, the phosphors on your screen, all of a sudden you've got a picture. So and so they are reflections of each other, but they are not the cause of each other. The signal has to come out from the television station for that to arrive at your TV. So the creator created. We're made in the image and likeness of the creator. We get to engage in creation. And my offering would be that our engaging in creation is what is manifest in our form. And our perception is a reflection that will tell us if there's hostility or fear involved that we're off base and we need to correct our creative process. When we engage in an energy, you know, the if you go to the cell biologist lab today, they'll tell you that when you think a thought, that thought produces a molecule, a literal molecule shows up in your structure. It circulates around in the structure until it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches. When it does, it lands on the cell. It inserts itself in the cell and shows up as chemistry. That's what the cell biologists are telling us. And when that molecule lands on the cell instantly informs us of the quality of the process we're engaging in. If we're engaging in mind energy that is of a disintegrative nature, thought disorders, hostility and fear, then the cell's going to reflect some form of hostility or fear. And it's a warning signal. It's telling you, you know, this is what you're doing to yourself. And the world has been doing it for so long that the world says, well, there's no other way to do it. Because we've been doing this for so long. Yeah, well, yeah, we killed 175 million people in war, you know, over a period of time. And yeah, we, you know, think that's okay. And well, really, for love to do that? Are you kidding me? So in our own individual creative process, given the ability to source mind energy, We're continuously being informed by our physiology, by its manifestation. And it's interesting, in the Aramaic language, the word manifest doesn't resemble what the culture talks about. You manifest your new car, manifest $1 million, you're going to be wealthy. The word manifest in Aramaic, a closer word to describe the word manifest would be obvious. So if something's obvious to me, let's say I come up with a power person dynamic where I know that when there's an authority around, I'm going to be attacked. Well, it's obvious to me that's going to happen. What that means is I've engaged in a creative energy that is going to send out a signal and call any authority within my field of the sphere of my influence. I'm going to call any authority in to abuse me. And so what I know is obvious is what is manifest, is what I bring into existence. If I know that, you know, no matter what happens, what's going to occur, what's obvious to me is that authority is always there to support me, then I'm going to create something totally different. I'm going to set up a different signal, and I'm going to resonate, pull some authority in to support me and bring about a higher result.
Right.
Is that fitting with your question? Is that answering?
Well, more or less, yeah. We kind of took the long way around. But I had a feeling when I was thinking, there's a feeling that came up when I was thinking about manifesting our perceptions in our body language, in our language, in our thoughts and everything. That is so powerful.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you did some research in the prisons. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say they did some research in the prisons, and they did the reverse of what we think of as the lineup, you know, a prison or a police lineup. They take all the possible bad guys. They put them in a lineup, and they have somebody standing behind a two-way mirror, and they look and they pick out the criminal. But they reversed that in this set of experiments, and they had people come into a prison where on the other side of the two-way mirror were the prisoners, the criminals, and they would bring John Q. Average in from the street and parade them in front of the prisoners. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but a significantly high number of people in the lineup that would be the target of the criminal were picked by the criminals looking through the two-way glass. Oh, there's the one I'd go after. There's the one. There's the one. There's the one. And, you know, I don't remember what it was, 70, 80, 90% of the criminals out of, you know, if there were 20 people in the lineup and there were 10 criminals behind the two-way mirror, 9 of the 10 criminals would pick the same one out of 20 that they would attack.
Right.
In other words, resonance. We're gonna draw people who are in tune with what energetic patterns we're engaged in, and the victim draws victims, and those who are in a consciousness and an energetic pattern of support will draw support.
Yeah. Amazing.
And so if we find ourselves, let's say, for instance, continuously in a victim place, that's where one would pick up the worksheets and start doing forgiveness around being a victim. Until that energy was disappeared, and once that energy of victimhood was disappeared, then no longer would they resonate people in who would victimize them. And that dynamic would change in their lives. So in the old days, what was obvious to them is I'm always a victim, and so they certainly had a great number of accusers and attackers. But when they moved into, I'm innocent and I always get support, then what showed up were people who saw them as innocent and supported them. Law of resonance. What's obvious, we manifest.
Right.
And if we're manifesting something, that's where we want to do our forgiveness work.
My daughter has, my one daughter that she was the black, what they call the black sheep of the family. She's the one that would break the rules and the one that would do everything that you didn't want her to do. She would
mm-hmm.
definitely,
right.
She would try her hand at it. And she just caused so much turmoil in the family with her decisions. And she's been calling
Question.
Me for the last couple. What?
Question. Did she cause so much turmoil? Or was
she
the one that set it into action so that everybody became aware of the turmoil that otherwise they lived their lives hiding from themselves?
Yeah. She had the DNA. She has the DNA of my grandmother. And
uh-huh.
she behaved just like my grandmother. And all these years that I've worked with this Aramaic Forgiveness and over at Heartland, inviting her, encouraging her, she's never taken me up on it. And
right.
so now she started calling me and talking to me on the phone, and we'll talk up to 4 or 5 hours at a time. And it's just like
mm-hmm.
once every 3 to 4 weeks. But when she's finished with me, she cries almost the whole time. And talking about her life and what's going on and what her and the kids have been through with the decisions
right.
that she's made and that others made. And and I keep encouraging her to stop living in the past and start living in the present. And I keep encouraging her to, I've given her the phone number for the Heartland Radio show to listen. And she just refuses to do it, but she just wants, it's like she wants to live there. And so I'm holding the space of love for her on the phone for just however how many hours. And I noticed that after we hang up, and I go to bed to go to sleep that night, I can't sleep. And it takes me about 3 or 4 days to get back to normal. The impact that I'm responding to these phone calls is like, I'm holding that space and I feel calm, but I'm having reactions in other ways to these phone calls. And
right.
I don't know where her intention is to call me and to put all this stuff on me. I can't do anything about it for her. All I can do is encourage her and do worksheets around it. And I've tried to break the phone calls off, you know, like put a limit to it, and she goes past it. I'll say, well, it's time for me to go to bed. And she'll say, okay. And then she starts on another tangent of something. And we go on and on and on. And so I'm at a loss on how to communicate to her. We need to keep it at a limit, you know. If she's not going to try to work on changing the way that she's looking at it, and she's just living it over and over and over again. One of her children was very badly abused by a stepfather.
Right.
And they still have it in court. It's been in court for 5 years, and it's just wearing on the family. And I keep encouraging them to forgive. The man was not born that way. And just keep going, you know.
So then my offering would be, in that situation, your forgiveness work would be to look at, if you were, let's say you were on the phone with her right now, it's getting late, you're tired, you've had a long day, what would be the ideal outcome? If she were to just spontaneously do what you want her to do, what would that be?
We'd do a worksheet together.
Okay. So then your forgiveness process around this at this point is going to be to cancel your goal to do a worksheet with her.
Okay. Well, you know,
and it sounds like, go ahead.
that might be my problem is I'm setting goals for her.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
I got to let that go.
That's right. So the other piece of the puzzle is that notice when you're on the phone, you'd like to control her. And it sounds like the goal that you hold in that specific situation, it's 9 o'clock at night and here she is, that the goal would really be for her to be sensitive to your need to complete the conversation. Sensitive,
yeah.
and for her to voluntarily let the conversation go. And then tie that back to what you said, and it might be worth going back and listening to the show again. Tie this back to where you started the conversation with her. She's the one that would do anything. And notice she's still doing it.
Yeah.
She's going to hang on to you on the phone. She's going to keep a hold of you. And you want her to be sensitive to your needs. So it sounds a worksheet around canceling your need for her to be sensitive to your need and your desires would be useful.
Right. The other thing I wanted for her was for her to take responsibility for what she's saying,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And
yep.
So she can have some choices here. It's like
there's your third worksheet.
She's stuck in this cycle, there. Which is called hell.
There's your third worksheet.
Yeah, okay.
Got it?
That's good. I got three good worksheets right now.
Okay.
All right.
Now wait a minute. We're not finished yet. Let's step back another step. And you remember how many times over the years when you come to Heartland to an intensive, you hear me talk about how having a child is like having your unconscious mind hang out in true living color and Dolby sound and everything you've never dealt with. They're going to do. They're going to bring it up. So, if you go back into your childhood, were you the one who would just keep it going? Were you the one that would do whatever setting everybody else in the family?
No, like I said, she is the exact DNA of my grandmother, and my grandmother was that way. And we would go out to eat. She was born on an Indian reservation in Oklahoma. And she had a wild side.
Your grandmother?
Yes, and she would drink. And we'd go out to eat in the restaurant, and if she was drinking, she could clear the restaurant, and we'd be under the table. She's and this was her... when she was drinking, this is the way she was, and that's the way my daughter is when she's drinking. And she drinks still every night she drinks.
Yeah. So what would you like her to do?
Well, the only thing I suggested to her that I think she got was she had to turn it over to God and just let him have it and move on.
Yeah. But would you really like to see her get sober?
I would like to see whatever it is that she's trying to relieve her pain from. I'd like to see that leave so she could get sober.
Mm-hmm. Next worksheet.
Okay.
Now let's go back to the days when you're in a restaurant with your grandmother and she's been drinking and clears the restaurant. What did you want from her?
I felt fear. And because when grandmother got like that, everybody around her was her enemy. I loved my grandmother. I loved her so much. And I don't care what she did. I loved her. And she had that kind of a personality, and she was so sweet when she was not drinking.
Right.
And she was one of the kindest people I ever knew. Now, what was your original question?
But
that lot.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Stepping into a little unconsciousness with support is a good thing. So if you'd had your druthers and you're sitting in the restaurant and your grandmother's doing her thing, you know, in your words, emptying the restaurant, and you were in fear, what would you have said to her if you could have changed her behavior? What would you have directed her to do?
First off, I would have let her know that I loved her.
Okay.
I would try to have comforted her to let her know that she was loved.
Okay, so notice this how identical this is with your daughter.
Yeah, that's what I do with her.
So, yeah. And so notice that your goal for your grandmother would have been to be open and accept your love and support.
Right.
And your daughter is a reflection of that.
Yes.
So exactly. That would be, there'd be a worksheet to do on grandmother and a worksheet to do on your daughter.
Got it.
And then let's go to the next level. If you were to look at the relationships that you've had in your life with men, was there a goal for them to be able to accept your love and support? Was it another reflection? I'm thinking back to when you first came to Heartland and you were at odds with your husband at that time. You were in the process of a divorce. Would that be a similar goal? Are you breathing?
Oh, I am now, yeah.
Okay, take a breath. Let's breathe into this. Breathe together.
You're
How
would
life
different.
Have been? Yeah.
We were on different pages.
And you were in the restaurant with your grandmother, you're on different pages. She's in her rocking, outrageous, can clear the restaurant.
Yeah,
and you're
on the warpath.
Grandma, I just want to let you know how much I cherish you. You're on different pages. You're on the phone with your granddaughter, and you're on different pages.
Yeah. Grandmother was in on the warpath, and Angela's caught in the cycle of her demise that she's lived through.
Hmm. And your former?
And the husband. I didn't even think he was getting the message at all.
Yeah. Is your daughter getting the message?
I doubt it. I doubt it.
Did your grandmother ever get the message?
I don't think so. Not when she was drinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when Angie's drinking, she's not going to get it either.
So my offering is that it sounds like what's coming up for you in those moments where you're in stress on the phone with your daughter, it's that whole dynamic that is your opportunity to clear out of your field so that you could be there with her and she's in her guilt or her blame or her victimhood, whatever it is, and she's had five drinks and she's just outrageous, and you could sit in a gentle breath and be at total peace because you've cleared your trauma out around that pattern in your life, in your body.
Right.
So that would be my vote for you, that you're able to clean that out of your field and be finished with it.
Right. So I will do that and just see how it goes.
Well, we'll be holding the space, young lady.
Well, sure. Thank you.
Nice,
thank you,
nice
baby.
Piece of work. Yeah, that's going to be really powerful for you.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I can feel it already. Thank
All
you,
right,
Michael and
awesome.
Jean.
Okay, blessings.
Bye-bye.
Very cool. Nice work. Okay. So we're down to about 5 minutes. If you're out there in listener land, there's time for one more conversation. If you're on a station we can't see you, our calling number is 563-999-3581. Give us a call. Let's have a conversation. Other than that, I did have a question from a woman today, actually, that sent me a message through Facebook. And her question was about the Greek translations of the Aramaic teachings. And let me just read the question to you. She sent me a link to a book about Aramaic versus English, and her question was, or her statement, I would love to your input on the significance of the Aramaic language versus the Greek interpretation and usurpation of the message. So I'll answer it for her and let her know that we talked about this on the show. My offering is that if Yeshua sat in most churches found in Greek Bibles, that he would say, that's all Greek to me. He would be, if we went back to the analogy I used in the beginning, he'd be the fly looking at the jigsaw puzzle compared to the mosquito looking at the jigsaw puzzle. They're not seeing the same thing. They may be standing in front of the same thing, but the perceptual apparatus has such a different foundation that one cannot conceive of what the other is thinking or experiencing. You might remember they said, east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. In other words, the Eastern expressions of the teachings of Yeshua do not translate into English, period. I mean, there are many cases where it takes literally a whole paragraph to represent what one word in Aramaic represents. I use an example. You know, you contact me, we have a conversation, we're going to do a series of workshops, and there's a fellow from Russia that wants to come to the workshop, and I know that you are an expert translator of Russian to English and English to Russian, in fact, the best in the world, and I know you've got an extra room in your house, and I say, well, gee, you know, we've got this fellow that wants to come to the workshop, would you pick him up at the airport, would you house him, would you translate for him, and you're like, oh, yeah, man, that'd be awesome. And you do that, and we spend a week together. And, you know, we have lunch and dinner with this person a couple of times. And at the end of the week, as you're getting ready to take him back to the airport, drop him off, and I want you to convey to him how I really cherish him and honor him and how I think of him. And so I say, would you please tell him before you drop him off that I think he's really cool? And you turn to him in your best Russian, and you say, Michael thinks you've got a low body temperature. You translated my words perfectly, and you didn't say a word about what I meant. Most of what the Greek scriptures convey don't say a word about what the man Yeshua meant. They say what the Greek gods had to say to men. And it's insane. And that's why people are living in fear and terror of a creator that, according to Yeshua, if you go to his native Aramaic, is love, and his good pleasure it is to give us the community of love. Which message? And we're down to the last few seconds, so I'm going to just say thank you for joining us. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pache, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mindshifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.